So I come from a natural science background. I then got increasingly frustrated to some degree with some of the natural science approaches, especially in statistics and environmental psychology and issues. So I got into science and technology studies. So the study of how we produce scientific knowledge. And through that, I arrived in social and cultural anthropology. So the study of how people live together. And I've now sort of come full circle to be interested again in environmental issues after spending a lot of time on medical anthropological issues. So basically what part of my research is or would be if I had time is to treat scientists like a distant or foreign or exotic culture. Yeah. So like some people drive to the highlands or go to the highlands of Papua to find out about the culture of groups there. What ethnographic science and technology studies people do is go into labs and go into research institutes and try to understand how these people, scientists, people like us, live together, try to find out about their culture. And these three things, environmental science, STS as it's called, so science studies, and anthropology fit together quite nicely when you start thinking about how we produce knowledge about this issue of global environmental change, how that affects society and what the interactions might be. And that's really meant to be the topic of my talk today, which I will now get into. So evidence-based democratic deliberation, global environmental change research and the challenge of social ecological cohesion. Evidence-based democratic deliberation or Willensbildung, maybe decision-making would be closer, but I opted for deliberation. It's not my term. It's a term from last year's review or assessment piece of the German Council, Advisory Council on Environmental Issues, the SRU, Sachverständigenrat Umwelt. And the social ecological cohesion has come into this, well, because we've been thinking a lot about social ecological cohesion, trying to put in a bid for the grand challenge of the Berlin University Alliance on social cohesion. But really what got me to this, I mean, we've been talking about this this morning a lot about the about third mission and science and society interaction. And I'm not entirely sure we are all on the same page. And I realized this when Thorsten Mayreis from theology and the Institute of Public Theology at Humboldt University invited me to a little symposium they did around issues of sustainability. And I was on the podium with a climate modeler from PIC. And I just mentioned sort of more by the by that there was a normativity to the way we produce, there were normative questions involved when we produce climate knowledge. And I thought that was sort of common sense and everyone would agree with that. And it turned out it's not. She got a little upset. It was all fine. But she obviously didn't agree because she had an idea that, or her position was that they were producing facts and that the normative questions came after. So I, in the aftermath, because this symposium then became, is in the process of becoming an edited volume, I wrote a piece on this, and this is what I'm now going to talk about. I've sent this piece, an earlier version of this piece, to Wolfgang Lucht, who also was very unhappy with it. so Wolfgang Lucht at PIC, one of the Earth System scientists there. And so what I'm trying to do today is basically upset everyone. No, I'm trying to outline my thinking on science and society. And this might sound like an old hat to some. This might sound a little weird, if not offensive to others. But I am convinced that we as in the community who's listening here now, we are really pretty close together on this. But it's important to recognize some of the different emphases. So I'm hoping, and I'm slightly worried about this, but I'm hoping that this format allows me to get across what I'm trying to do with sufficient nuances for people not to think I'm just a nutcase. If you do think I'm a nutcase, well, you know, you can always opt for a different director who represents more adequately what's going on at IRI Thesis. So let's get into this. Evidence-based democratic deliberation, global environmental change research, and the challenge of social ecological cohesion. Feel free to ask questions. I'll try to keep an eye on the chat. while I'm talking. So my core argument, in a nutshell, at least that's what I'm hoping to talk about, is this. I think, first of all, socio-ecological cohesion is the sine qua non for any societal transformation in the Anthropocene. So if we want to affect, or if anyone wants to affect a great transformation in late modern societies, this has to start with socio-ecological cohesion. And I think we're increasingly facing a problem with that. Socio-ecological cohesion, I want to argue, rests on ideally globally shared responsibility or shared ownership for our knowledge of global climate environmental change and its consequences. And that is certainly not the case at the moment. And we need to rethink science and society relations in order to foster socio-ecological cohesion. So what I'm trying to argue here is a different way of conducting global environmental change research in a very broad sense of the word, conduct this in a different way so as to engage society in a different way and foster social ecological cohesion to then enter into transformation processes and not leave people behind, as the hashtag has it. That's the idea. I'm trying to do that in these steps. First of all, I want to outline the dilemma of global environmental change research, or the maybe more narrowly climate and climate impact research in particular. But I'm really talking about an entire epistemic culture or thought styles approaches from global circulation models and climate models, integrated assessment models, all the way into much more social ecological approaches, tipping point research, some of the land and climate research, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, really on all, across all scales and on all issues. So I'm not singling out an earth system approach or something like that. So I want to outline this dilemma that I see, and not only I see, also John Schellenhuber mentioned this this problem in a recent FATS article, but I come to this. And then I want to suggest that the solution that's often given, namely labeled here as evidence-based democratic deliberation, which I think is a great idea, but that this solution probably raises three questions or problems or ways how that might not be enough. And I talk about these three here, and then I just conclude with something about shared responsibility and social ecological solidarity, which will everyone give everyone at the end a nice and warm feeling. So I hope we agree on that, all of that in the end. But let me outline my reading, and it might be obvious to everyone, but my reading of what I think the problem is as far as social cohesion and knowledge is concerned. So I think the fundamental problem that we are experiencing is that we are disappointing expectations that people had in modernity and in modern development. Essentially, most people think of progress and development, be they individuals or be they nation states. I think of progress and development as continuous socioeconomic growth and consumption based on renewable resources. And that counts for nation states and entire economies. But also, if you look at kind of the iconography of success and development and progress and social mobility, upward mobility, if you look at pop stars and sports people and top managers, it's all about having more and having bigger things, basically. Yeah. So that's enshrined in modernity. And if you're not modern yet or differently modern, you aspire to being modern in that sense. You know? And of course, the Conference of the Partners, the Paris Climate Conference in 2015, at the very latest, has shown to all state leaders that this is not going to happen. And certainly not going to happen for everyone. And it's not going to happen if we continue the way we do. And I think that was a great transformative moment that this could be reached and acknowledged on a global stage, that this idea of kind of the Euro-American West going forward with modernity and everyone else sort of coming along, trickling down or whatever we want to call it, that's not going to happen. It can't happen and it will not happen because of planetary boundaries. Now, I assume that I don't need to say anything about planetary boundaries here. If you kind of forgot momentarily, here's the diagram of one of the latest versions. There's another version being worked on, but I won't really say anything about that. I assume that this is clear. One thing I do want to say, though, is that this entire body of research on global environmental change is really undergoing a shift, or has been for some time now, in an important transition from largely biophysical or biogeochemical matters, natural science matters at heart, into more and more social dynamics, or the co-evolution of natural and social dynamics. So exemplified on this slide here by the addition of social tipping points to an established literature on Earth system tipping points. So I also assume that I don't need to say much about that, about permafrost and pole caps melting and Gulf Stream, etc., Earth system tipping points. And we're now increasingly, this is this excellent paper by Ilona Otto and others at PIC, on social tipping points, on the question of how carbon pricing, taxation regimes, urban governance, etc., might be leverage points or tipping points that would propel society into different directions. So what's happening here is that a group of people trained in natural science, largely natural science thinking and methods from physics, etc., in modeling terms, is shifting into a terrain that is much more to do with social dynamics. And that's important, as I will show in a minute. Right. So this is what's going on in the background. And my argument would be that this disappointment in modernity, it endangers at the moment, is beginning to endanger social cohesion. Why is that the case? Well, social cohesion as a sociological term is really defined with core elements of social mobility, particularly social upward mobility has to be possible, social capital, so people have to be able to accumulate different forms of capital and network, etc., and inclusion. And the problem now is that if you're facing these planetary boundaries, that take for example, the notion of social upward mobility, this idea of upward mobility is not available anymore if it is clear that there aren't enough resources to go around, assuming we keep our way of living and running the economy as we have done before in our resource use. Yeah, so there's a fundamental mismatch between the basic pillars of social cohesion and the threats or the pressures that are put on us through planetary boundaries. And this is something that we need to deal with. Now, let me come to what I think this is the dilemma of climate impact. I'm switching here between climate impact and global environmental change research. Doesn't really matter. You get what I mean. Now, the way the way people are trying to address this largely, and that's perfectly understandable, is I'm just switching between things here. Is by relying on objectivity. In a sort of, I'm using this as a naive term here, as an objectivity. Facts and ever more precise and reliable predictions of the consequences of unsustainable development are meant to convince people to then change their behavior or politicians to change trajectories for national economies and so on. The problem with that is that in many milieus, this objectivity tends to lead to reduced interest, if not to increasing rejection of this idea. Of the idea of more climate evidence. And John Schellnhuber, I don't know if you read this this week or last week in the FATS, in the piece on pandemics in the Anthropocene, worth reading, had this, and I have translated this here, said, while in the last weeks of the pandemic, the respect for medical and scientific experts has increased to well-deserved admiration, a skeptical or even hostile attitude towards climate science continues in parts of the public. And I think that's diagnosed correctly. And I think that's what I mean. This is a major problem, because if we assume that we need society as a whole to affect these transformations, we can't lose people. So we should leave no one behind. Now we can all envy, as Wolfgang Lucht was asked this morning on Deutschlandfunk, we can all envy epidemiologists or virologists and why they're being listened to, and we can certainly talk about this in the discussion. But I think it is true that people are getting reluctant to take up climate evidence. Let's leave it at that. And the dilemma is, of course, that providing more facts and more accurate information is the obvious thing to do, and it's the necessary thing to do but it doesn't solve this problem. It doesn't bring people on board. It doesn't lead to more social ecological cohesion. So the question is, now what? What do we want to do about this? Now, the answer that the German Advisory Council on the Environment has given, and I'm quoting here a bit of a lengthy one from this Gutachten on the Legitimacy of Environmental Policy in Germany from last year, worth reading. I want to stress it, even though I'm being now slightly critical of it, but it's a very well thought through piece of writing, especially also on the bringing together the legal and the natural science side. But they're saying, it is true that in democratically constituted societies, the definition of the limits to be observed during change is the result of an open goal setting process, especially since it entails considerable political, economic, and technological consequences. However, this cannot mean that the setting of limits can be made without regard to scientific facts and can therefore be decided at will. From an Earth system science perspective, every decision is associated with concrete explorable risks that can only be subjected to non-scientific disposition to a limited extent. In this way, science, in this case Earth system analysis, is a crucial instrument of evidence-based democratic deliberation. And in German, it's demokratische Willensbildung. That's not straightforward to translate. So I think that's a great quote. And if you read John Schellenhuber's piece in the FATS, he speaks of a Grundvertrauen we should have in science, so a basic trust we should have towards science. And with that, I have a bit of an issue because I don't think, and as I will show you, I mean, I don't think this is about sort of a fundamental trust like you have in a family, but it's a much more a critical form of engagement that we are looking for and that I will now try to advocate. So I think what the SRU is saying here is dead right, but I don't think it goes far enough. And here's one issue that I see with that. It is based on an understanding, largely, I would assume implicitly, on an understanding of science and society as separated, and separated in two steps. So first, there's an empirical determination of the scientific fact base, i.e. the planetary boundaries. And then after that comes a normative discussion of the consequences, right? And that's how science and society interaction and science communication is thought of. Let us get the facts right. Let's get them as precise as possible. And then we bring in society when we're debating what that means. And when we then take obviously normative and value-based decisions about who ought to be paying for this, how the costs of this and the risks and the benefits could be distributed, et cetera, et cetera. And with that, I disagree. And I'd like to show how. And I see three problems with that I want to outline. One labeled when they read what we write, situated knowledge and post-colonial critique, all really well-established problems, but I thought I reiterated in this very heterogeneous group so we can get afterwards in an exchange over sort of the nuances and how we stand on this, because I think it does remain controversial. Now, when they read what we write is the title of a very in anthropology, very famous edited volume that deals with a problem that anthropology begins to face, really from the 70s onwards. What does that mean? Well, it means that until the 1960s and early 70s, anthropologists from the global north have really gone to remote places, studied the culture of a people, and then come back and written this up in English or in French, largely, and discussed it within the academic community. And the people that was written about, the people who had the culture, so to speak, they never read these ethnographies. So that was all easy. No one stood up and said, "Oh, look, you know what you're writing about me is actually complete nonsense." Now, this changes for many reasons, for political reasons, for ethical reasons. There's a big upheaval in the anthropology of the 1970s. There's decolonization in the world as a political and social movement. People in English and social media and all kinds of other electronic media make these things available. Plus, anthropologists like myself and others are working more and more at home, so within the global north, within Euro American countries, et cetera, et cetera. So more and more, we get to the situation where people whom we study read what we write. And that often doesn't end well. and that makes things very complicated. And the main issue I'm pointing out with this quote, which I'll just read through briefly, the main problem is usually not on the factual side. The problem is usually not that someone stands up and says, what you say about me is wrong. You don't understand what my life is like or what our culture is like, whatever you want to call it. But it's a different one. So let's look at this quote. The people under study, and this could be Earth system scientists or whoever else, may be aware of some errors of fact or interpretation that the academic observer has made. But generally, and more significantly, it is because the academic observer has interpreted things in a different way from what they would have done or has emphasized different factors of the society, or has held up his mirror to reflect the society from an angle which the society is unaccustomed to. There's also often an understandable feeling that it was improper, impolite, or offensive for certain things which are considered highly personal or sacrosanct to be revealed openly, particularly in written form. Now, this is a very sort of poignant quote and issue in anthropology, because anthropology is a very socially interactive method or uses very socially interactive method. Ethnographic observation or participant observation over an extended period of time of a year or two within a particular group of people leads to friendships, to social relations, to reciprocity, to obligations, etc. So people are very attuned to how this relationship goes on after you leave the field. But I don't think it's restricted to the ethnographic method, but it really goes for any research, be it sociological or indeed be it earth system science, increasingly talking about social tipping points. Now, you can talk about the climate, and the climate won't mind if you talk about it. The climate will never read what we write, but people do. And the basic message of this slide and of my first point is people just don't like being talked about, as simple as that. People are very, very sensitive to being talked about, and they are particularly sensitive to being talked about when the talking is done without understanding the circumstances within which people find themselves. So a lot of the work on shared pathways, et cetera, and on the tipping points, a lot of this work exerts an enormous normative pressure. Yeah, you ought to be doing this. It's asking people to do something. So it's quite invasive in that sense, quite an intervention. But it's doing that on the basis of very abstract and macro socioeconomic data, structural data, if you like. What it's not doing, it's not starting, and that's what I outlined this morning, why I think we desperately need the CRC. What this is not doing, well, it is not starting from the lived realities of people. And these are people sort of across the street, in the villages and in the cities, lay people, if you like, citizens. But these are also people involved in policy and governance issues, etc. They also have an everyday work life and they need to get things done. And if you start talking about them, or if you start talking about them and sort of demanding things of them, and even if you don't mean it, they become sensitive to these issues. And I think part of this climate science is they and them, and it's nothing to do with us. So this us and them divide that we're seeing in the climate issue results from this. It's talking about people without understanding their lived realities. So that's my first point. We need to attune global environmental change knowledge, align this with people's lived realities much more than we are doing now. And there's a lot to learn for people on the on all fronts of research, really, including my own area of European ethnology and social anthropology, where we know very little systematically about lived realities in Brandenburg and how that changes as the climate changes. We do mainly short-term projects, so it's not just, I'm not accusing global researchers here of ignorance, but I'm saying every one of us needs to think differently about this, about lived realities of people when we want to affect transformations. That's my first point. My second point is sort of staple diet for anyone in STS or philosophy of science and history of science. It's about situating knowledge. And it might, many people probably can't hear it anymore, but still, I want to make this point because I still think it's being misunderstood and people are very worried about acknowledging the situatedness of their knowledge, especially in the climate of fake news and post-truth, etc. So, situating knowledge, what do I mean by that? Well, the simplest way, leaving out a lot of the feminist critique that this stems from now, the simplest way of describing this is to acknowledge that scientific knowledge is decision-laden. Yeah? So when people like John Schellnhuber are saying, well, you know, you can't go back or circumvent natural sciences, and we're in Corona, we are seeing that if you're not going with the laws of the disease, you're being punished. That is, of course, perfectly true. And this might also be true to some degree for CO2 emissions. But of course, what science isn't the kind of the midwife of natural laws, right? It's not that there are natural laws out there and they're simply being delivered through science, which in itself doesn't really sort of mingle with what's going on. But instead, of course, scientific knowledge production is an everyday practice and it's full of a million of decisions that need to be taken. And I'm not saying they are the wrong decisions, or you know, we should be taking different decisions. I'm just saying that that's what happens, and these decisions are made in very specific historical and social circumstances. Now, for example, there's a huge urgency and political and public pressure on climate research, and that changes how we make decisions, what we prioritize, what we do first, what we think we can do later, etc. So this is what it means to acknowledge that this situates knowledge, the fact that we, at a particular time, in a particular institution, as a particular person, make particular choices in the research process, leads to situated knowledge. And if we acknowledge that, which is really hard to deny, if we acknowledge that, then we acknowledge really a dual normativity of knowledge. So it's not only the normativity and the kind of the social implicatedness of the consequences of scientific knowledge, but also of the production itself. So the production of knowledge is not a value neutral or ethically, in some sense, neutral process, but it's socially situated. And that does make a difference. And I will show you what kind of difference that makes. And what Baudelaire Latour has famously said, and what has upset many people, is that we ought to shift, and I still think this is a good summary of this debate, of the consequences of this debate, this shift from matters of fact to what he calls matters of concern. And the basic argument here is that there's a world out there, and at the moment, when it comes to environmental issues, societies, politics, etc., and also the social sciences are waiting for the natural sciences to deliver us this world, to represent it in a set of facts. And then we debate about these facts, you know, what are the consequences of these facts? And what Latour is saying, and I think many, many people in the social sciences have joined him now in this, what Latour is saying, well, let's not wait with our political implications, with our critique and with our social implications and with kind of the normative analysis or the ethical appraisal. Let's not wait for the natural sciences to deliver us to deliver the world to us as facts, but let's get involved in this fact making because it is decision laden. So let's move this sort of critical reflection of knowledge production, let's move that forward. Let's not wait for the facts and then go on, but let's move this forward. And that is beginning to suggest a very different relation of science and society, namely one where it's not science delivering the facts and then society debating the consequences, but society getting very much involved in the production of these facts. Now, the risk is, of course, and what a lot of people are saying is, well, there's no way I'm letting some sort of right-wing Brandenburg populist, he's usually the actor in this, some right-wing Brandenburg populist mess around with my climate models. That's a total waste of time. That's really dangerous. And that's really, really bad. We need to be as objective as we can be. That's absolutely true. But nevertheless, I do believe that we should get that right-wing Brandenburg populist involved in the climate model to the extent that he or she realizes what kind of people are doing what sort of research for what reason. Yeah, going back to Christoph Keller this morning, we need to show people what we are doing. And who knows, this right-wing Brandenburg populist might have a fantastic idea how to run your model better. And I know this sounds naive, and it's probably not the best example of trying to bring AfD voters into global climate modeling, but it's a matter of principle. And I'll try to explain this in an example here, and then on my next slide on post-colonial critique, where this is becoming more tangible. So I'll try to give an example. I think it's probably from Tobias Kümmerer's work. I'm not even sure whether he's still with us. No, I don't think he is. Well, that's probably good. but I just chose his because it's a nice sort of middle range. So think of an example of conservation work and land science and conservation work in the southern Amazon basin or the northern Gran Chaco, so sort of central South America. And I'm trying to outline to you three kinds of three ways in which situatedness matters and can be handled. So the first one is what I label here is probably inner scientific uncertainty, which is absolutely bog standard in the kind of research we are doing. So take forest degradation as an issue. So you're interested in how land systems change in a particular region in South America. So you're doing a sort of social network analysis. You're using remote sensing to assess forest degradation and deforestation patterns. You're interviewing a lot of people. You're doing a biodiversity assessment, like an ecosystem assessment stuff. And you're bringing all this sort of data together to understand whether we should spare land or share land and where fences should be and what areas we should protect. Very, 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 very complicated stuff. Very, very exciting. So a typical problem that shows situatedness in a very simple sense is you have a data set from remote sensing that shows you, gives you an idea of patterns of forest degradation in your region. And you also have a bunch of local scientists from the area who have a lot of expertise and are probably going on walks and have charted this territory differently. And you're finding these two data sets are not going together or you're lacking certain parts of data. So there you realize that two people or two groups looking at a similar issue through being in the world differently and having different technologies at hand, being trained differently, both trying to understand forest degradation, but they do so in different ways. And in an ideal world, the two data sets come together and you talk about it and that all works. And in the other world, they probably don't come together and you have to find out where mistakes are and all sorts of uncertainties arise from it. And you might find out you're actually talking about two different things and you have a different understanding of what degradation means and that it becomes more conceptual, etc. That's bog standard science that results. So uncertainty begins to result or begins to come up as an issue of different positions on the issue, different visions of the problem, framings of the problem, and you need to solve them. So that's no problem. Science can deal with that. We're used to that. And we don't really need to bring in society in that sense. The next line is much more complicated, and this is very hard to explain and a deeply anthropological issue, but jagios as persons. So in the area you're dealing with live a number of indigenous groups, and I'm using indigenous here with scare quotes, but let's call them indigenous as a placeholder for the moment. Next slide will be more on that. Indigenous people. And these indigenous people will come up to you and say things like, well, we really consider jaguars to be persons and not to be part of nature in the sense that you talk about this. Now, what do you do with that sort of statement? And there's a lot of work on this by Eduardo Viveros de Castro and others on this sort of multinaturalism in Amazonia. So I'm not sort of making this up, but there's a grand literature on this in anthropology over the last 20 years. Very, very interesting, very, very hard to comprehend. So you're meeting a person, meeting someone in your fieldwork, a local group, and they say to you, well, we consider jaguars to be persons. Well, the response to this could be either, well, you've been drinking, this is just nuts, that's no good at all. Or you can sort of laugh at it because it's obviously wrong. But if you start to take, if you want to take it seriously, you have a big problem because you cannot understand what they're saying, right? Because we are so ingrained in Western thinking, scientific rationality, and Western cosmology, that a sentence, well, a jaguar is a person, makes absolutely no sense. Makes no sense to me either. But of course, you can could go and live there. You could read volumes on anthropological work on Amazonia, and you can begin to comprehend what it means when people say that. But what it essentially means, and I won't go into this in detail, but what it essentially means is that you have a totally different understanding of the border or the dichotomy of nature and culture. Essentially, there's a continuity in spirit, which means that jaguars and humans end up on a continuum, whereas other divisions are made elsewhere. So they're ontological, as we call it, there are ontological differences between the way this indigenous group is in the world and perceives the world and practices the world and the way we do it in Western science, right? So what do you do then? So it's not a local scientist who tells you, well, we have different data on forest degradation, but it's someone who says, well, basically we live in a different world. How you've classified all this doesn't match up at all with the world we live in here. Now, what do you do? Well, the first thing that's very difficult to do is understand what these people are saying. And that might take you some time. So there's a huge learning to be done in trying to understand what people like that are saying. And it's very, very hard to capture through the kind of survey instruments that we tend to see when indigenous knowledge is being assessed as part of ecosystem service assessments. But let's assume you understand this. Then there's two things you can do. And I want to point out both. One is, and we're doing neither at the moment, really. One is you can negotiate the consequences of these ontological differences. So you can say, well, I've got my world, you've got your world. Let's talk about how we can bring this together. Either my world wins or your world wins, or we find some sort of compromise. And this is very, very hard to do. And especially hard to do because the first question is, of course, are we negotiating on Western terms or are we negotiating this on indigenous Amazonian terms, or on what terms are we negotiating this? So very hard. So that's one way of doing it. You're just looking at the consequences of this. The other thing you can do, and that's what I'm really advocating, and it might sound nuts, but bear with me. The other thing is that we should be, as we call it in anthropology and in feminist critique, diffracting the different ways of being in the world and perceiving the world. And diffracting, like in physics, as a metaphor similar to reflecting, means we are essentially reading one perspective and one way of being in the world through the other. So we're putting ourselves in the shoes of the other. So let's say we're using some sort of land science model, some land use model that gives us something about forest and social practices and tells us about land use change in the area. Now, what happens if someone with a totally different ontology in their mind, for whom this land we're looking at, this territory, is totally different? What happens if they start using our model? All right, so we teach them how this model works and they start using it. So they bring in different parameters, they value different parameters in their different cofactors, etc. And so they basically adopt our way of being in the world in the sort of Western rational way, but with their ontological background. And we can do it the other way around. So we try to understand their way of being in the world and try to understand the problems of, for example, forest degradation or shifting land uses through their way of being in the world. Yeah? So, and then we are not only negotiating the consequences, they stay in their world, we stay in our world. But as a methodological exercise, if you like, we're trying to put ourselves into the respective other shoes. That is, of course, extremely laborious. But that's my idea of how I see science and society coming together. It means make people see the world through scientific eyes, which is what Wolfgang Lucht and John Schellnhuber are suggesting. But it also means learning to see the world or be in the world through other people's eyes. And that's not what we're doing at the moment. And of course, you know, your average climate scientist at the moment is pretty busy, like any other scientist. So it's not easy to do. But we need to think of structures and formats and how we can do that if we don't want to perpetuate science and society divides. So situated knowledge, if we're thinking about evidence-based democratic deliberation, situated knowledge is how do we produce part of this evidence? What's the scientific process? And I'm saying where we should involve society, groups of societies differently in that. This last slide, postcolonial critique, is posing the question, what is part of the evidence base? You can look at evidence-based medicine, where I guess this term comes from. And if you want to know what evidence is in evidence in medicine, then it's basically everything that can be shown through randomized controlled trials, right? That's the golden way. Problem with that is that you can't test everything through an experimental design that lives up to a randomized control trial. You can't have double-blind studies, for example, on all matters medical. So you end up with other forms of evidence. You have to broaden your evidence base. Now, traditionally, what we do is we assume that anything that wants to count as evidence has to follow basic principles of scientific rationality, right? So reason and rationality. We don't want to admit any sort of nutter's point of view to the evidence base. That would get us absolutely nowhere. Well, the first thing that's worth recognizing, of course, is that scientific rationality is specifically Western and specifically modern, right? It's contingent. And I really recommend here Stanley Tambaya on the link of magic, religion, and rationality or science when it comes to rationality. Now, I'm very happy and easily convinced that reason and scientific rationality in our sort of Euro-American enlightened sense of it is a very good way of organizing societies, and it's a very good some very good set of criteria to organize our living together. But it's not the only one. So it's worth being aware that this is not an easy universal principle that somehow can never be questioned. Then I've talked about ontological differences already, and I put Viveros de Castro down here. So it's worth being aware of ontological differences and what sort of rationalities they bring to the table. And if you look at what IPBES is doing in biodiversity governance on bringing indigenous or giving voice to indigenous perspectives, that's going in a very interesting direction. Now, the next one is, and I'm seeing in the question from Klaus already, certified scientists, whether future scenarios can be evidence-based. Yeah, I'm coming to that. Thank you, Klaus. making, and I'm not talking about the future issue yet, so I'll pick up on that. The next one is the difference between local expertise and certified knowledge. And that's why I picked the example from Tobias's, so the fictional example from Tobias's field of research. An old debate in science studies: are we admitting only certified knowledge to the evidence base for democratic deliberation? So do we need to publish all this in scientific journals with peer review and some sort of quality measures and quality control? And what happens to other forms of local expertise, people who know about landscapes, about resources, about whatever environmental dynamics that we're concerned about, or social dynamics that we're concerned about, because they're part of it. And they've found their own way of knowing it, of experiencing it, of labeling it, etc. Do we need to translate all that into certified Western knowledge? Do we find different ways of admitting this to the evidence base? And there's a lot of work to be done. And of course, there's an asymmetry in how many people put money and resources and man and woman power into certifying knowledge, and the often much less organized forms of local expertise and experiential knowledge. And that brings me to my last point here, namely indigeneity, one of these labels that's become popular in trying to empower, in a very positive way, become productive in trying to empower indigenous forms of knowledge and experience. That in itself is then problematic because local groups have to sort of certify themselves as indigenous, and that splits communities, and what happens to knowledge that's local but not indigenous, etc. So there's a whole issue there that's being addressed in the community by and large, but I think where more could be done. And of course, the key question here for me, with now more and more people, look at Patrick CRC and others, looking at Germany, looking at Berlin Brandenburg, where does indigeneity begin? Right. This always seems to be an issue of the global south, of Latin America. But what about Southern Europe? What about Brandenburg? What about our neighbors? I mean, are they indigenous in ways that we ought to be recognizing? And that brings us back to our Brandenburg right-wing populist. Now, is that a legitimate local / indigenous perspective? that we need to take into account and value, or is this just is that just a nutcase? You know, so how is the right wing populace different from the Amazon group in the Amazon? So there's an issue there of trying to develop criteria how to distinguish or how to understand to what extent particular opinions are rooted within walks of life, cultural practices, and historically grown, or to what extent they are sort of ad hoc, or even worse, strategically, politically motivated, right? And depending on those distinctions, we can include and take knowledge and experience into this evidence based or not. And then my final point before concluding is really summing this up. And that's a point I made earlier, but I wanted to reiterate it earlier in last year. And this is the difference between, or the need to bring together integration and difference as two fundamentally different thought styles with which people are dealing with globality or globalization or global phenomena. Now, we all know the integration style. Typically, IPCC is the perfect sort of evidence-based, evidence-producing machine, an amazing integrational effort of so many clever people. And it's producing evidence through the integration of certified knowledge on a global level, right? We're just adding studies. We're aggregating data. We are generalizing. We're abstracting. Because how else could you talk about a global phenomena if not adding data up so you can talk about it at the global scale? Well, that's true. For these phenomena, that's definitely the right way of going about it. And I have no problems, well, no problems that we want to discuss here with the IPCC process and others of globaling, a global modeling nature. But there's a whole totally different way of dealing with globalization and the globality of phenomena in the social sciences and humanities. There, we value and sort of foreground difference in two ways. Well, first of all, practices of human differentiation, as German sociologist Stefan Hirschau calls this, is an anthropological constant, right? So if you put three people together, they will start differentiating. They will form groups. So there's an up, there's a top, and there's a bottom, and there's a left, and there's right, there's distinction, there's identity politics, there's in-groups, and there's out-groups. So that's what humans do, right? So if we're interested in social tipping points and social dynamics, we need to talk about difference, and we need to recognize difference. And then the problem with difference is that you can't really get rid of it. The whole point of difference is that you have to work with it. You don't integrate it away, but work with it. So the comprehension and recognition of epistemological and ontological pluralism, stemming from these differences that I outlined for the Amazon, for example. So the comprehension and recognition of epistemological and ontological pluralism is the basis for global knowledge, if you believe post-colonial scholars, decolonial scholars such as Chakravarti Spivak or Walter Mignolo, and a lot of others. And I don't want to go into the difference between D and post-colonial here. So that's pretty much the opposite of integration. It's looking at the at people globally and trying to appreciate in how many ways they are different, how they differentiate themselves, how they deal with the homogenizing forces of globalization through trade networks, etc., how they're trying to escape it, how they're trying to use it, how they're appropriating that. Now, so we have integration and difference, and I put this sort of vertical bar in between in the header because it's all about trying to keep these in a productive tension. That's why I put down there. These are perfectly legitimate styles of knowledge production, of course, dynamics, and they need to coexist. And they do coexist at IRIS thesis, but we have to put a lot of effort into bringing them into what Chantal Mouffe and other political theorists have called agonistic tension. So the tension of recognizing that something's very different, integration and difference, but acknowledging that they need to be kept together, right? That's the kind of the basic of Mouffe's political theory and how societies should act. Recognize difference and constantly work on the differences. Sort of bring out the differences and make them productive rather than making them go away. And I think we can do more at IRIS thesis to find ways of working in that way and to putting more effort into that. And with that, I have a set of rather sort of weak conclusions. I think the separation, I hopefully have shown some of that, the separation of science and society into, and I'm polemically simplifying, into facts and values, so science does the facts and society does the values, does not produce knowledge around which people coalesce. It does not foster social cohesion or social ecological cohesion, because at the moment we are losing a whole bunch of people for a very complicated set of reasons, but it has also to do with us. Now, if people are meant to show solidarity for things in nature, which I would like them to, because if you want social ecological cohesion, there's the ecological in there. So if people are meant to show solidarity for things in nature and for people far away, because it's a global issue, then to my mind, that really requires shared ownership and responsibility, or a sense of shared ownership and responsibility for knowledge about global environmental change and its consequences. And that's where I think I meet what Wolfgang Lucht said this morning on the radio. The same way that people now learn about the virus load, etc., in epidemiology, the same way they have to somehow engage with environmental climate change research, only that it's so far removed from them that they won't do it. So it's up to us to make sure that people come on board. And that might make things a lot more complicated. But if people don't get a sense of this is our knowledge, and I mean that in a sort of in a global sense, in a very naive global sense, that this is our knowledge, and start sort of empathy is probably the wrong word, but decide to go in for solidarity for nature and for people far away, then I think we are on the wrong path. So we need to engage people to create the sense of shared ownership of this knowledge and of this knowledge production. For that to happen, science and society, and here another unclear relation as yet, need to enter a phase of genuine mutual learning. So it's not about science communication, to give shape to social ecological cohesion. And if we manage that, then social ecological cohesion is the starting point and not the end point, or not only the end point, but it has to be the starting point for any great transformation that we're trying to start. And with that, I thank you for your attention. And if you want to read up on some of the things because you don't believe what I'm saying, here's other people much cleverer than I that have written about this. Thank you very much.